The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha! Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. My name is Braden DeVos. I'm 7 years old, and I have a favor to ask you. Will you please protect the environment for me and the other children in the world? Thank you. Now take it, solar guy.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on this Tuesday, October 15th. As most of us know, on Monday, September 9th, 2013, a molasses spill occurred from a leaky pipe connected to a Matson ship in Honolulu Harbor, leaching as much as 1,400 tons or 233,000 gallons of molasses. As of September 20th, the Department of Health reported that dissolved oxygen and pH levels had returned to normal. The response has still transitioned to the recovery and restoration phase, and the incident command post has been closed. DLNR has now taken the lead for the recovery and restoration of Honolulu Harbor. Like many environmental accidents, they make big news, but seem to trickle off, even though these impacts are lasting. Here with us today, we have an exquisite panel, Dr. Robert Bitigeri, Dr. Greg Stewart from the University of Hawaii, and Fraser McGillivray from the Division of Aquatic Resources, Department of Land and Natural Resources, to talk about where we stand on the spill 36 days later and how government and scientists are moving forward. Up first with us is Dr. Robert Bitigeri, a professor at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks. So you've been working for a while now, I guess 36 days, with some of the samples from Honolulu Harbor. What was your initial response when you first heard about the spill, and what were you most concerned about?
Well, I first saw the news, you know, via television that there was a massive spill, and was puzzled why there wasn't a greater response, I guess, from the university level. No one was really mobilized to go out and sample. We have the capability to analyze samples for a wide range of different activities, bacteria, algae. And so we decided to get some colleagues together and run a small boat and go out and sample. And we weren't working totally in the blind. We were closely coordinated with DLNR as well as the Department of Health, so we could complement our sampling and sample the same sites that they sampled.
So molasses, I mean, that's just sugar. Why should we be so concerned about a natural substance?
Well, it is a natural substance. However, it's very rich in nutrition, especially for bacteria. And so when this large quantity of molasses was dumped into Honolulu Harbor, the first thing it did was it blocked the penetration of sunlight because of its brown pigments called melanoidins. And this reduced the phytoplankton growth. And the bacteria, which do not use light energy in most cases to grow and divide, took advantage of this high nutrition condition of the harbor. And so the bacteria essentially bloomed. And by using up the molasses substrate, they also depleted the oxygen. And when we were out sampling, there was an extremely sweet smell in the air resulting from volatiles in the molasses. But we could also smell reduced gases such as hydrogen sulfide. In addition, there were, due to ladder analysis, huge, huge amounts of methane that were produced by the bacteria themselves.
And of all the species or organisms in Honolulu Harbor, which, in your opinion, were the hardest hit?
Well, In my opinion, I think the hardest hit were the things that aren't mobile. So the fishes could have perished due to, you know, just being covered in a blanket of molasses, could have been due to the low oxygen, the hydrogen sulfide. So they were pretty wiped out. The invertebrates were wiped out, including corals. Now, once the system was flushed and all the bacteria removed through bacterial activity, then fishes can, you know, swim back in, migrate back in. The water column can get back to normal fairly quickly, you know, due to the bacteria as well as the flushing. But things that aren't very mobile, there's a lot of crustaceans and other organisms that when they sense danger, they go into the sediment. And so they were blanketed with this material. So I think in the end, I'm not a coral expert, but I think the hardest hit and will be the corals, and they may take the longest to recover.
And working with the microbial communities and plankton, how did that shift from pre-spill to post-spill?
Well, I can talk about the phytoplankton. There's a group of diatoms that form the base of most fisheries throughout the world's ocean, and that's the diatoms. And based on our sampling over time at the site, we observed that these diatoms were replaced by a group of algae called dinoflagellates. Certain representatives of the dinoflagellates are harmful algae and produce red tides. And luckily, our microscopic examinations carried out by the UA showed that the dinoflagellate phytoplankton that bloomed were not of the harmful bloom variety.
And so are there long-term effects that we're concerned about? I mean, what happens now?
Well, there could be some long-term effects. We are in the process of sending out samples of the source material that we obtained from the EPA, who got material from the ship as it was being loaded with the molasses in Honolulu Harbor. And we're sending it out to various labs that are certified in the analysis of priority pollutants, such as polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which are carcinogenic. These compounds are produced during the production process for molasses, and there's typically a water washing step that removes most of the PAHs, but there have been reports in the literature where there still may be significant quantities of PAHs in the molasses, and we're just investigating that. We don't know if that's the case, but once they're in the harbor, they would associate with sediments and not be flushed out with the sugars into the open ocean. So, you know, there is a potential that these compounds could be passed up the food chain and there could be a longer term effect, but that's just a hypothesis at this point.
Now, you referenced the literature. Has something like this happened before, and is there documentation of it?
Well, there were actually several cases that I have been able to study. There was one that occurred in 1919 in the city of Boston. And in that condition, 10 times more molasses was released into Boston, into the streets of Boston, than was released in Honolulu Harbor. So this was, instead of 235,000 gallons, it was 2 million gallons. And this molasses formed a wall moving fast at about 35 miles an hour at a height of about 10 feet, and it killed many persons and caused many injuries. There was also a case 10 years ago on Maui where 50,000 gallons of molasses was dumped into the ocean during an operation there, which was the source of the molasses that was being transported to Honolulu Harbor for storage in their tanks.
And so did that Maui spill get as much attention, or was there a lot of research or baseline studies done during that spill?
Not to my knowledge. In that particular spill, it was observed right away, so they were able to stop, you know, huge amounts of molasses coming in. I think the other issue with the Honolulu harbor is it's the circulation is relatively restricted. There is flushing of the harbor. But prior to this event, there wasn't a good circulation model running to know where the molasses would even go. So the EPA, working with NOAA, stepped in and tried to adapt some numerical models to actually predict where the molasses might end up.
So as I understand it, the University of Hawaii scientists are working quite closely with EPA and NOAA and the state and with all these government agencies. Has that been an opportunity for you to work with people that you haven't worked with before?
Absolutely. The response at the state level was relatively weak in terms of the higher political persons in charge. But Brian Schatz actually brought in the Coast Guard as well as the EPA and got everybody, at least catalyzed the situation to get everyone working together. And this, we all sat down at about 8 days after the spill, and we all came together and worked very efficiently together. And it was, you know, for a horrible experience, it was, you know, a positive experience in terms of, you know, working with people that really had their act together.
One of the silver linings. Well, this is an amazing topic, and we have so much more to cover. But let's take a quick traffic break. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, Leakmaster Roofing, Kama'aina Solar, Grand Solar, and BenQ Solar.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
No big problems right now. The last accident was on Alakava Street at Nimitz, so over there by Best Buy. If you're going east to Hawaii Kai, looks good. No problems going over to the windward side on the Pali, the Like Like, or the H3. If you're going west, typical, the H1 slows about the halfway point on the airport viaduct. The Moanalua slows at Moanalua Gardens. Inbound traffic from the west is slow from Middle Street.
Aloha, this is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free, besides aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at
554-7200. Aloha nohoi kako and ho mai kai nohoi praise to Jeff Davis.
You're terrible at this.
I'm terrible.
I love you, Ruby. Aloha.
Marco Miuskovic here from Hawaii Money Resource. Join me every weekday at 2 to learn solid financial strategies that might help you protect your finances. Tune in to Hawaii Money Resource every day at 2 right here on 760 KGU.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
Aloha! Welcome to Oahu's Tomorrow. My name is Braden DeVos. I'm 7 years old, and I have a favor to ask you. Will you please protect the environment for me and the other children in the world? Thank you. Now take it, solar guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. With us now is Dr. Greg Stewart, also a University of Hawaii Department of Oceanography professor. And as I forgot to mention before, both Bob and Greg are also with the Center of Microbial Oceanography Research and Education, also known as CMOR, and have been studying ecology the ecology of plankton for over 24 years. So we are in a room of great minds and lots of experience. Now, Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. So you've also been involved with the Honolulu Harbor molasses spill and collecting samples. Has your experience been similar to Bob's, or what has the process been for you in terms of utilizing these samples? What are you doing?
Right. So I was actually brought in, contacted by my colleague, Matthew Church, who was involved in the sampling. Bob contacted Matthew Church and started to spin up a sampling program, and Matt came to me to get me involved to assist with some of the analyses of bacteria.
And so when you say analyses of bacteria, for those of us non-scientists listening tonight, what exactly does that involve?
Well, one of the most basic things we do is count the number of bacteria in a given volume of water, or figure out the concentration of the bacteria. And we also doing a little bit more sophisticated analyses using some molecular techniques to figure out what species of bacteria are present and how they may have changed in response to the molasses. Now, we don't have that latter data yet. We've just in the process of analyzing those samples to look at the community composition, what types of bacteria responded to the molasses. But we could still tell quite a bit just from looking at the concentrations of bacteria. And what we could see was, as we would have expected and predicted, the bacterial concentrations were quite elevated in the area of the spill compared to the concentrations we would typically see in other similar environments.
So how does this compare to other environmental disasters or other environmental problems like runoff after a heavy rainstorm or an oil spill even? Would we see similar bacteria changes, or is this different?
It is different. Each one of those scenarios you described has slightly different properties, and different things are being introduced to the water, and that's going to those differences will influence the types of bacteria that respond. So in the case of runoff, for example, there will be some organic matter in that, but a lot of what we see is nutrient runoff. And so after storm runoff, often you'll see primarily response of the phytoplankton responding to the nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, and the stratification of the water. Where you have freshwater runoff, it tends to sort of float on the saltier water. And then there's lots of nutrients in that water, and it's exposed to sunlight. So you often will see a strong phytoplankton bloom, followed by bacteria, which respond to the production by those phytoplankton. In the case of oil, there you have an incredibly carbon-rich and very low nutrient, nitrogen and phosphorus being the major macronutrients that things need to grow. So there are bacteria that can break down the carbon, but it's the carbon that's in petroleum products and oil is rather difficult. It's difficult for bacteria to break down. There are bacteria that can do it, and they will do it. Nature will clean up an oil spill, but it can be quite a bit slower. Now, with the molasses, it's sort of a mixture of the two, where you've got lots of really carbon-rich material, the sugars. There's lots of organic carbon there, but unlike the oil, the sugars, pretty much any bacterium is capable of breaking down and metabolizing sugar and growing on sugars. It's one of the fundamental energy sources that most living things are capable of growing on. So in the terms of the molasses, it's rich in these sugars that will stimulate the growth, but there are some nutrients in there as well. There's nitrogen and phosphorus, but not at super high concentrations, so probably not enough to stimulate a severe phytoplankton bloom or a harmful algal bloom. Because there's so much carbon there, as the bacteria are growing on it, metabolizing that carbon, they're going to need some of that nitrogen and phosphorus as well. And there's small enough amounts of it that they probably get most of it.
So, if we think back to our grade 5 science class, let's say, we learn phytoplankton and zooplankton. Those are the base of the food chain. Those are important. did this shift in bacteria or did the spill, how did that influence the other species in the ecosystem, specifically with the bacteria? Did that affect fish populations, or is it too early to really tell?
Well, as Bob was mentioning, I think there was an immediate effect just from the molasses itself. And that, coupled with the fact that these sugars are so easily metabolized, meant that the bacteria started growing quite rapidly. And in the process of growing, just like all animals, including ourselves, when we consume food, which is organic carbon, when we consume the food, we're also burning, using up oxygen in order to burn that food to get our energy. And so when the bacteria started growing very rapidly on the molasses, they also started using up the oxygen that was in the water. So the first ones that are going to take advantage of that sugar, the fish can't eat the sugar. They feed on other fish or small particles. They're particle eaters. The things that really eat dissolved material like sugars are the bacteria. That's what they specialize on, is consuming dissolved carbon in the water. So they're the ones that would have rapidly responded. They get the first crack at that material, which means they get the first crack at any oxygen that's available, and they drew the oxygen down to extremely low levels. And that was bad news for any other animal that lived in that environment, because they need oxygen, but it's all been used up by the bacteria.
So in terms of the next steps that need to happen, as you process these samples and look at this, are you going to continue to go back and take samples, or where are we moving forward from here?
Yeah, I'd like to get some additional samples. So from the sampling we've done so far, we saw that there were quite elevated concentrations of bacteria. So typically what you'd expect in that environment would be, say, a teaspoon of the water from the harbor. Under typical conditions, you might expect to see maybe 5 to 10 million bacteria in a teaspoon, which sounds like quite a lot. But these are bacteria that are always there. They're part of the environment, and they're a natural part of the food web. Now, in the areas where we saw most of the molasses, the greatest concentrations, they were up to closer to 30 to 40 million per teaspoon of seawater. So they were elevated by about a factor of 3 to 5-fold. So what I'd like to see is, but then with the next sampling, about a week later, we went back and looked at the concentrations, and they had dropped substantially, so it seemed like things were returning to normal. But we still saw fairly high concentrations in Keihi Lagoon. And what I don't know is whether that's a normal condition for Keihi Lagoon, because I haven't sampled there before, or whether this is a residual effect from the molasses. And by sampling again, we should see if those numbers are coming back down.
So in your opinion, do you think the harbor will be able to make a full recovery?
I would expect so. Certainly in terms of what's living in the waters, Bob mentioned, those things that are mobile, and especially the plankton, they get flushed through the harbor pretty quickly. And so any planktonic organisms are going to recover most quickly. Mobile benthic organisms may also recover next. And I think the hardest hit, as Bob already mentioned, are those things, particularly the sessile organisms, those things that are attached to the bottom in particular, like corals, and other things that just don't move very fast. It's going to probably take a lot longer for those sorts of organisms to recover.
Well, that is definitely a silver lining, though, that there is going to be recovery, and we at least see recovery with some of the species. Now, this is somewhat of a unique event, so I imagine that this data set will be valuable in terms of learning lessons for the future and how these species respond to events such as this.
Yeah, absolutely. We're looking forward to looking at the community composition data. When we do the molecular analyses, we should be able to pinpoint exactly which types of bacteria most aggressively responded. And in a way, those will be the ones that we should probably thank. They're sort of a mixed bag here. They're partially responsible for the problem in that by consuming the molasses, they used up all the oxygen, which ended up killing a lot of organisms, a lot of animals. But at the same time, the very act of consuming it means that they are in the process of cleaning up the mess.
I think a lot of times people don't think about those smaller organisms when they look at the marine environment as a whole, and they really do play an important role. And this is kind of a unique situation, and as I understand, you've also had some students involved in the sampling as well?
Yes.
And how do they respond to being involved with such an important event?
Oh, I think he was very excited to be part of the action. This is a student who joined my lab. He recently graduated from high school and was waiting to decide what he wanted to do about college and was looking for a project and came in the lab at the right time. And maybe his second day in the lab, we sent him out on a boat, and he's been pretty excited about learning all the techniques.
That's a pretty cool project to start your career on. Well, thank you so much. This is really important, really interesting information. We're going to take a quick traffic break, and when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the management side of the spill. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, University of Hawaii Research Corporation, State of Hawaii Natural Energy Lab, Kona.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Traffic this afternoon looking fairly normal, although we have had some heavy spots on the west side. If you're going west from now, the slowdown starts at the airport exit on the viaduct. The Moana Lua slows at Fort Shafter Flats. Inbound traffic from the west slows on both freeways as you get to the Middle Street merge. Going to be slow from there to the Punahou exit. Normal to the windward side and Hawaii Kai.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Aloha, it's Jeff. Is it hotter in your home than out on your lanai? Do you wish there was an energy-efficient way to cool down? Wouldn't it be nice to turn on the trays at the flip of a switch? Well, my friends at Island Cooling have been quietly promoting the energy-efficient whole house fan for years. It works by drawing fresh air through your home, pushing the hot air out through your attic. Call the whole house fan experts at Island Cooling, 672-2300, 672-2300, or go to islandcooling.com. Aloha.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education, this time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. And aloha.
So you're doing the right thing. You're getting a solar voltaic system for your home or business. But did you know the crucial decision is which microinverter to choose? A microinverter is what's going to convert the sunshine from your solar panels into electricity you can use.
But not all microinverters are created equal.
The Enexis microinverter system dramatically boosts energy harvest with higher wattage microinverters. We're talking up to 40% over its competitors. Year after year, you'll be getting more bang for your buck.
Because not all microinverters are created equal.
So make sure your contractor offers the Enexis microinverter with the system you can monitor yourself. Your system will shine today and be ready for a brilliant tomorrow. For more information, visit enexis.com. That's enexis.com. E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com. That's E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. And today we're talking about a very important subject matter, the molasses spill that happened in Honolulu Harbor 36 days ago. With us now is Fraser McGilvery. He is the administrator of the Division of Aquatic Resources with the Department of Land and Natural Resources for the state of Hawaii. Fraser has more than 20 years of experience in marine conservation and ecosystem management, spanning the globe from East and Southeast Asia to Melanesia and Polynesia. So quite a lot of experience. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So the management and administration who has responded to this spill has played a very important role. There have been both federal and state partners involved. Has it been a fairly smooth process working with all these different agencies?
Yeah, everyone seemed to come together for the greater good. Most of the agendas and baggage was left at the door and actually come in and address the issue of the molasses spill.
So which partners were involved in the spill cleanup? Because there are so many federal and state acronyms and agencies, it's hard to sometimes keep track of it all.
There was letters all over the place. I mean, we had Department of Health, obviously, Department of Transportation. We had DLNR. We had the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, U.S. Coast Guard, USGS, University of Hawaii. And, of course, we had Mattson in there, who were in there from the very beginning as a major partner.
So is this the first time that all these agencies have worked together on something like this?
No, this has been done before. And there's been a couple of emergency responses, plannings, and kind of like emergency restoration stuff that's had to be done in the past, such as the USS Port Royal and Cape Flattery. So these agencies have worked together on these issues previously or on emergency responses.
Was there anything that surprised you in terms of how well you all worked together?
Not really. I think everyone realized that there was a job to be done. Everyone had a unique position within the response system and collaborated and cooperated very well to actually address the issue at hand.
And, you know, sometimes these situations can get a bit confusing to the public. You know, there are so many agencies. How do you determine who has jurisdiction over what? I mean, I know Department of Health started off and now you guys are taking the lead. How do you delegate all those assignments?
Well, the Department of Health is basically the primary agency, and they respond to reports of oil spills and chemical spills in the area. And the Department of Land and Natural Resources is the lead trustee for the state as the kind of the owner and the lead agency for the public trust resources, and those were the resources that were impacted by the molasses. So this is why the Department of Health initially led the response, and once the initial response phase was over, passed that over to DLNR.
So now that you guys are taking the lead, has it been hard for you since most of our federal partners are not working right now, or has it been fairly smooth sailing for you?
It's been very smooth sailing. I mean, the major federal partners were actually still in place for the majority of the planning for the response phase and then the planning phase and after that. So we had good collaboration with a number of these partners, the federal agencies, before they were unavoidably laid off for the time being.
And the response phase is now officially completed. Is that correct?
The response phase is now officially completed, and that's why Department of Health have transferred the responsibility of the investigation and the assessment over to DLNR.
And so what did you guys learn from the response phase? How is that going to help inform how DAR moves forward now?
I mean, the response phase allowed us to basically look at the origin and the nature of the spill. It allowed us to estimate the quantity of molasses that was spilled into the area and then approximate the affected area of the spill to actually go out and look at the impact to the wildlife and the types of wildlife that has been impacted by the molasses.
Was that did that really impact you when you first saw what the impact was, or is this pretty much what we would expect to see from this type of event?
I think everyone who saw it was affected by it in different ways. It really depends on the individual as to what their individual response really was. As as Bob mentioned earlier, you know, this has been, these type of things and molasses pills have been seen in various places in the past in historical means, but this is the first time that we've seen this to such an effect in the harbor. So it's, everything was relatively new, and we had to go on, establish responses and establish mechanisms to help us get through this.
So now that DAR is involved in assessing the extent of the damage, how will you execute or assess the damage?
We've put together a monitoring and assessment plan that we'll be carrying out over the in the future. And currently, we're initially looking, we've assessed where the area of damage is, primarily based on the corals that have been impacted in the harbour and in Kehi Lagoon. And we'll be continuing to investigate that as well, mainly focusing on the corals at this point. But the plan will also be to look at the other invertebrates and also the fishes in the area.
So will you be using a lot of these scientific monitoring techniques that some of the researchers have already put into place?
We'll be using standard scientific monitoring techniques as, you know, as part of our assessment plans. Yes, I mean, this is stuff that has been done elsewhere, is a standard practice, and it's done by many of the partners, and UH are you know, have also been doing this as well. So this is something that Department of Land and Natural Resources is familiar with.
Excellent. And do you anticipate the assessment process to be long, or how long do you think that will go for?
The assessment's basically going to be in phases. So it really depends how long each phase takes us to complete. It depends on how long, you know, it takes us to analyze and look at the, you know, the assessment pieces and look at the monitoring. So we really depends. We can't say at this point just how long that will take.
And what are the next steps after you do the assessment?
Basically, what we're looking to do is quantify the area of damage and the loss of the natural resources and the ecosystem services that those resources produce. And then we'll work with the Department of the Attorney General, basically, to see what the next steps will be.
And I know there's been a huge emphasis on the ecological response to the spill in Honolulu Harbor. What about other considerations in terms of the effects on related industries like fishermen or future transportation plans?
I think once we've completed our investigation, these results will obviously be at some point in the future will be available for a broader review. And it's we hope that various other agencies, such as the Department of Transportation, can weigh in regarding this, how this information could be used. The impacts have been documented to both the harbour and within Kehi Lagoon. There's obviously a variety of kind of commercial and non-commercial activities that take place there, and that'll obviously be taken into account as well by other parties.
And is there any contingency plans that are going to be developed in response to this spill or for other hazards or other types of spills?
I think at some point, Department of Transport has obviously obligated all the tenants on the harbour property that have pipelines to inspect them, certify it, and have spill containment measures put in place. Obviously, we're all learning as we go forward. One of the outcomes of the incident response phase is to actually take a look at how everybody did respond to the incident and look at how did we improve on these measures. So we're constantly learning and we're constantly improving the process.
Well, that's important, is, I guess, learning from all of these things. It's basically what all you can really do. Do you have something that you think has been the most positive and the most negative aspect of the spill that you've learnt from so far?
To be perfectly honest, I don't think we've had any real negative responses as such. The positives have really, you know, by far and wide been very they've been very strong. The partners coming together and actually, you know, focusing and working together to lessen the impact of the molasses and actually, you know, respond effectively has been incredibly positive. And I think one of the key things to say is, like, you know, Mattson's immediate statement to say that they were committed to the cleanup was obviously one of probably the most positive thing that we had at that stage.
And have you gotten a lot of positive or negative response from the public in terms of the spill?
I think that the public have understood what had to be done and what needed to be done. They've been incredibly supportive to these efforts. We've greatly appreciated the public and their efforts to respect the closures of Keihi Lagoon, which had to be done for a number of reasons. And when we did manage to reopen it to the public, we were glad to be able to do so. So the public have been incredibly supportive in this measure.
And so you mentioned Keihi Lagoon, which is not where the direct spill occurred. Has there been monitoring of the marine resources over there consistently as well?
We've monitored both the harbour and Keihi Lagoon, and this is part of the ongoing assessment, yeah.
Oh, good. And in terms of which agency normally deals with these spill situations, is there money or funds set aside for emergencies such as these so that government can respond real quickly to spills or other environmental hazards?
I think from a DLNR perspective, you know, we have very limited funds, and we're incredibly grateful for the cooperation of other government agencies who have rallied round and collaborated in this regard.
This is amazing information. I'm really happy that you're able to respond to some of this. So I'm so appreciative for you to be on the show today. We're going to take a quick traffic break, but I'd like to conclude the program by asking a couple more questions. So we'll take a quick traffic break. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, DR Horton Schuler Homes, Hank's Taxi Service, and Island Cooling and Wholesale Fan.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
The slowest traffic right now is going west. The Moanalua isn't too bad. It slows at Moanalua Gardens. But if you're going to take the H1, it's stop and go from the airport viaduct to the stadium. Take the Moanalua if you still have a chance. Inbound traffic slow from Ola Lane to the Punahou exit. The drive over to the windward side is fine. No problems going out to Hawaii Kai.
If you would like to contact Jeff either about the program or have any other questions about solar photovoltaics or hot water, call 554-7200. That's 554-7200.
Aloha, this is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free, besides aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at 554-7200.
Over the past century, more than 90% of koa forests in Hawaii have disappeared as tropical hardwood prices have skyrocketed. Hawaii's koa forests are an important part of our ecosystem and a symbol of our island heritage. Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Hawaii's Tomorrow need your help to repopulate 1,000 acres on the Big Island with new koa trees. For $60, you can sponsor your very own koa legacy tree on the slopes of Mauna Kea. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Along with a beautifully engraved personalized certificate, $20 will also be donated to the charity or organization of your choice. Gift a gift that grows grander year after year. And see how simple the act of planting a tree can change the face of the planet. To plant your Hawaiian Ko Legacy Tree, go to hawaiistomorrow.com and click on the Legacy Tree icon. Again, hawaiistomorrow.com. That's Hawaii's with an S, tomorrow.com.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opilioahu.com.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis, with a sure bet for you and your family. If you or someone you know believes they are living in a neighborhood that has no room on the grid to install more photovoltaics to erase your electricity bill, I can do it. I will guarantee to get your home approved by HECO, or I'll give you $100. Again, if you need PV on your home and you're under the impression that your neighborhood or your grid is full to saturation, I, Jeff Davis, the solar guy, can get your home installed and connected to HECO's net metering program, or I'll give you a $100 call-up bill. You just call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200, 554-7200. Aloha.
If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's 2 decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
Want to go green for your home or business? Hawaii Community Reinvestment Corporation introduces its new Green Sun Hawaii program, an innovative public-private partnership to make energy improvements affordable for everyone. Green Sun Hawaii gives you the power to significantly reduce your utility bill. Visit Hawaii National Bank or other participating lenders or one of the many authorized energy contractors for more information. Or visit greensunhawaii.com and click on the easy-to-use loan application.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. We're talking the molasses spill in Honolulu Harbor with my esteemed panel, and I'm going to wrap up our talk today with all three of my guests, Dr. Robert Bidigeri, Dr. Greg Stewart, and Fraser McGilvery. Now, Fraser, we were finishing off talking about some of the accomplishments and some of the strides that the management side, both the state and federal government, has dealt with the molasses spill. When there is something such as this, is there an emergency protocol system that gets put into place? I mean, who gets called first? What's the chain of command there?
I mean, there is there's protocols for this type of thing. Generally, the somebody will see it, and there's actually an emergency line. There's a hazard evaluation and emergency response line that the Department of Health has. We hear from DoCare. We hear from the Coast Guard, and there's generally a, for want of a better description, a phone tree. It's not quite as simple as that, obviously, but between the state and the federal partners, so everyone can come together very quickly and move on this to actually get an incident response moving swiftly.
And I guess this is a question for all of you today. In a lot of these situations, or the environment in general, we have scientists who are evaluating the ecosystem, and we have management who are trying to deal with people. And how does that all come together for you? Where can science and management better align to respond to these types of spills? No, it's a tough question. what about education? I mean, is that a way that we can we can better align some of these processes and educating the public, or having some of our scientists working to educate management about some of the science they find when they are out in the field?
Well, I think we've all had an opportunity to meet new people and develop new collaborations and partnerships, such that if another spill, whether it be oil or molasses or product X, that we've already have associations. We can also use the information gained to educate the public, including, you know, the general public as well as students in the classroom. I know that we will be using the results of this experiment in our classrooms.
And that is, to me, something that I think is really important, is taking some of these real-world examples and bringing it into the classrooms and having students learn from that. Greg, I think you were mentioning that you used this example on one of your exams?
Yes, the midterm exam that was just handed in today had a question for the students about the release of nutrients from the molasses and the likelihood of that triggering a phytoplankton bloom. So I like to, where possible, to draw on these real-world examples, because it makes the problem more appealing and more immediate and helps the students be more interested in finding out what the answer is. So I hope they'll agree with that.
And has this topic been sort of a buzz topic amongst your students?
It has come up quite a few times. I actually put in a couple of questions on the exam related to molasses, not just the one, but so it has come up in lecture, and we've talked about it a bit, and it's certainly been in the media quite a bit and a top of a discussion.
And in terms of being able to share your science or share your data, in your opinions, this example, why is baseline data so important, or what role has baseline data played in your research with this particular molasses spill?
I think having that baseline is absolutely critical, and this is the second time I've had this experience of going out to sample after sort of, I guess, catastrophic event, and to my dismay realizing that we had no data from before with which to compare the current numbers. And it so having some sort of routine monitoring and assessment, some monitoring of the environment is critical, because if you don't know what the state is, then when something like this happens, you can't really tell what the response was. And another example of this was the large sewage diversion that happened back in 2006, I believe it was, with Waikiki sewage pipe in Waikiki cracking, and they had to divert all the sewage into the Alawai Canal. So the beaches were closed for quite a while, and someone ended up being pushed in the harbor, getting cut up, and ultimately dying of his wounds, and died from a bacterial infection. And this bacterium is a bacterium that's normally found in the canal, but there was no data on how abundant this bacteria was prior to that event. So it was impossible to say whether the sewage spill had anything to do with the infection that resulted in this case.
So I think you draw on a really important point that, you know, even though this is not an ideal situation, it's a situation we can all learn from, whether it's from the science side or from the management side. In moving forward, what is the hope you have in terms of using this data, or using this experiment or experience for your future work? And this question goes out to all of you.
I think from our perspective that it's very important that we do gather this data, that we do analyze it, and that we do use it for lessons learned, and also to the data being gathered now could potentially be the baseline for the future. We are hoping that the environment will recover. There's obviously we know that there's significant impact to corals. We are hoping that they do come back. They may not, but only time will tell, and we'll continue to monitor these and gather the data to allow us to determine the effects long term.
And that is a perfect message, I think, to conclude with. I want to take some time to thank all three of you for coming out today. You're very important, and you've been able to share a lot of knowledge with us. I'd also like to acknowledge the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Hawaii's Kosi Island Earth, both who help contribute to the show. Kosi aims to connect marine science issues with both the visitor and local communities. I would like to give a special thanks to Jeff Davis. I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.